starting pitcher for the Indians, Trevor Bauer, making his 12th start, 5-2 record.
Strikes it out on the swing. Good pitch.
Good pitch.
That rung him up. Two down. And I mean, Bauer just ate him up with a two-seam fastball that ran in on his knuckles. Napoli, but Lonnie Chisenhall launches one deep to right.
How
back is Markakis. He's out of room. It's out of here. A three-run homer for Lonnie Chisenhall, and the Indians jump out to a four-to-one lead here in the fourth.
And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of crowd that stood up. They get greedy.
Make one. Deep right. Back goes Markakis, still going back. He makes the catch, no, drops the ball. Coming around third, Ramirez, he is flying. And he will score easily into second as Naquin. It's 7-2.
I think Mike took a job because he wanted a head job, and, you know, he had to accept me. There's no question. Mr. House already hired me. I hired my defensive coaches. I was a defensive coach. I tried to be nice and do the things the way they're supposed to be done, but I think Mike had a hard time adjusting. Sure, I want to coach in the National Football League, and I want to be a head coach. I tried to get one job, and they had all kinds of rumors, assistant job and everything else, but I only tried to get one job, and that was a Tampa Bay job. I had the most fun in Philadelphia I've had in all my coaching. Everybody thought, man, that was tough. It wasn't tough. Hell, you know, I enjoy tough situations, I guess, because we really had a lot of fun.
I love what I do, so that's my motivation. My motivation is working with young people and going back to trying to help them be successful. I mean, I don't have to coach another day of my life. I don't have to win another game. I don't have anything that I feel like, hey, I've got to prove this. I got to stay in the game and prove this. I love working with these young women and helping them strive to be the best they can be.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And a great, great afternoon to you. Thank you for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, for what we like to call the afternoon extravaganza. 2 hours of good discussion and dialogue, and if necessary, depending on the conversation, maybe even some debate. Bob France with you. Jim Cushlin is here as well. Kind of a bit of a, you know, a subdued open to the show today. The montage, some Indians highlights as they continue their 10-game winning streak. Well, they continue their winning streak now. At 10 games is, I guess, the best way to say that. We will talk a little bit of baseball as time goes on this afternoon, but you also heard some other things that are obviously a little bit more important. The passing of the legendary defensive coordinator of the 1985 Chicago Bears, obviously went on to be a head coach in his own right as well, but will always be renowned for his work as the architect of the famed 46 defense that the Chicago Bears used to win the Super Bowl in 1985, still arguably the greatest defense in the history for a single season anyway. Maybe not for extended period of time. I'm sure the folks who are fans of the Pittsburgh Steelers will argue for the Steel Curtain circa 74 through probably 1980, maybe for a 6 or 7 year run as the best defense of all time. The Ravens might argue that their 2000 defense was maybe the best ever. Maybe the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for a single season in 2002 when they won the championship against the Raiders. All of those teams certainly will have arguments, but for a lot of folks, especially people old enough to remember watching that Super Bowl live, watching the Bears decimate the Patriots 45-10, and watching, most importantly, them play for an entire season, they were something to behold. The Chicago Bears 46 defense was just something ridiculous, and it was indeed, to a man, even to Mike Ditka, of course, who is the famed coach, Coach Ditka of the Bears. Even he acknowledges this was Buddy's defense. It was his team, and so obviously now, with his passing, it's another time to reflect on his career. And he was also one of a kind, by the way, when it comes to, being an individual. He was a hysterical individual. He had some of the greatest one-liners, some of the greatest quotes, you know, that you hear from a sports figure. And there's a nice little compilation of those that I read earlier today. I'll try to share some of those with you as we go. So the passing of Buddy Ryan actually came later in the day. When we found out about that, it was actually after the other obviously very solemn note that you heard in Jim Cushlin's montage there. And that, of course, was what he wrapped with, and that was the passing of the legendary coach of the Tennessee Lady Vols, Pat Summitt. This is, you know, the lead story, I think, almost for all sports today. And the reason why, it's not to favor one person over another in a terrible time like the passing of somebody, you know, that is a legend in their profession. But there are legends and there are legends. And what I mean by that, I'm sure you understand and realize, is, you know, one can be legendary for doing a great job. One can also be legendary for building an entire sport, building a program that helped build a national sport, an identity for a national sport. And while the great Buddy Ryan was great at his job as a defensive coach and a guru, et cetera, it's just a little bit different when you talk about Pat Summitt. And that's why so many people today, you know, in sports shows, it's, you know, when you do what I do and what Jim Cushlin does for a living, you know, you're taking in as much as you can. And, you know, I'm listening to ESPN programs this morning on the radio right here on The Ticket. I'm watching some of the programs and some of the other networks as well on television and reading different coverages at, you know, in blogs and other websites. And while everybody goes back and forth on the equally sad passings of two great coaches throughout their history, Pat Summitt's story resonates with, I think, more people for more reasons. And this is the difference between being a legend and being a legend. And I know that may not mean a whole lot to anybody, but Pat Summitt, more than being one of the winningest coaches of all time, 8 national championships, 8 national championships, more than just being a winner, Pat Summitt really literally helped build women's basketball from something that it was not to something that it is today. And what I mean by that is, over the course of 40 years, you know, she started in the early 1970s. She took her first job in the early 1970s. I want to say it was 1974. From all the coverage, I'll get all these numbers and years dancing around in my head and win totals and everything else. But she started in the early 1970s at a time, and I think it was exactly 2 years after Title IX was implemented, 2 years after Title IX became the law, providing equal access and facilities, et cetera, for women's sports that men's sports have. And she started 2 years after that as the coach, you know, a college basketball coach who was making, I think I heard the number today, $8,900 a year. $8,900 for the year. And to earn that money, she had to do more than just coach. She had to do everything, including laundry, washing her players' uniforms between practices and between games and road trips and et cetera, et cetera. She did it all. And what she did along the way was to build something and to bring awareness to, let alone popularity, but just even awareness. Oh, the women are playing too? I didn't realize. To a point where, you know, that was at the beginning. Oh, there's a women's game too? I didn't realize it. To, oh my God, Tennessee is coming to town. Not the boys, not the men. The Tennessee Lady Vols are in town. The Tennessee Lady Vols, during Pat Summitt's heyday, particularly when the championships were a-flowing, in the late 80s and then the 1990s and in the early 2000s, when she won 8 national championships. Pat Summitt's impact on all of that, she turned them from a sport that people didn't even really pay attention to or know existed into the Dallas Cowboys. She made Tennessee Lady Vol basketball a thing. I mean, Cowboys type popularity in the college world. Now, for a lot of people, for a lot of young people today who might just say, you know, well, Gina Auriemma's won more than that. Look at UConn. Yeah, indeed. But that wasn't built from scratch the way that Tennessee Lady Vols basketball was. women's college basketball wasn't built from scratch until Pat Summitt sat down and started to build it, quite frankly. Not that she was the only one. Don't get me wrong. She was the winningest coach in men's or women's NCAA history. That by itself is an extraordinary accomplishment. But she didn't do it alone. But while she didn't do it alone, no one did it better. And no one was more impactful. No one was more instrumental in the development and the growth of the game. There are just so many stories about her that I could just sit here and read them all day long. I'm not going to pretend that I know everything about Pat Summitt. But I will say this, as a fan of college basketball growing up in the era in which the Tennessee Lady Vols were dominant, and of course toward the end, she had just some incredible rivalries and games and Final Four appearances and so on and so forth in which she was matched up against Gino Auriemma. And I can tell you this, Gino's a guy. And while I have a propensity toward guys' sports, as most men do, NFL, NBA, MLB. We don't watch too much WNBA or too much women's college softball. We watch baseball instead. While I have a propensity toward that, I rooted for Pat. I'm being honest. I always rooted for Pat Summitt and the Lady Vols. When they had those showdowns with the Huskies, or they would play Notre Dame or any of the other top women's college programs, I was a fan. I mean, I was in. There was something about their swagger. There was something about the way they won. There was something about her unbelievable glares. I mean, her sideline presence, her demeanor during games was one. I mean, the stoicism with which she carried and presented herself on the sideline. Had she been a guy, I think would have been recognized a little bit differently. I mean, you know what she was? And it's funny, and I literally just thought of this. This was not planned as part of my opening monologue. Really, none of this is planned. I'm just speaking from the heart about my memories of and the coverage of Pat Summitt today. But, you know, I said a minute ago that she turned the Lady Vols from, you know, one team in a sport that very few people even realized was being played, if that makes any sense, to the Dallas Cowboys. She turned the Lady Vols to the Dallas Cowboys. I was about to say, she was Tom Landry. When you picture Tom Landry on the sidelines, and if you're a younger fan in the millennial generation right now, you probably don't have a whole lot of memories of Tom Landry. But the legendary coach of the Cowboys, you remember how that face just never really changed, that stoic look on the sideline, that kind of glare out into the field, always focused, always locked in, not angry, not furious, not mad, but just not smiling and not happy too much either, just focused on the job, focused on the players, focused on the mission at hand, no matter what the score. That's Pat Summitt. That's what I remember anyway as I watched her. Some of the numbers defy description, to be honest with you. Some of the numbers are simply difficult, if not impossible, to really comprehend. Let me give you a few of them. Pat Summitt won 1,098 games in her career as a head coach in NCAA Division I. 1,098 games, the most by any Division I coach, men or women. She averaged almost 29 wins a year. And those 1,098 wins look amazing, but they look off the charts, incomprehensible when you put them next to the 208 losses. Let me say that again. 1,098 and 208 in 38 years. Her winning percentage at home, 91%. Her winning percentage on the road and at neutral sites, almost equally impressive, including tournament games. Her 1,098 wins is better than Mike Krzyzewski, still going, of course, and he will indeed pass her probably in two seasons because he has 1,043 and counting. Then there's Tara Vandeveer, Sylvia Mitchell, and C. Vivian Stringer on the list, just in case you're wondering. Her winnings percentage at home, I mentioned 91%, on the road, 79%. That's right. You're winning 8 out of 10 games away from your building. 0 losing seasons in 38 years as a coach. 0. She played in 13, her teams did, in 13 national championship games at Tennessee. She made 18 Final Fours. The graduation rate for her players in 38 years, 100%. Every Lady Vol who completed their eligibility at Tennessee graduated. Her rivalry with Gino Auriemma that I mentioned a few minutes ago, talk about dominance personified. Auriemma and Summit battled one another a total of 22 times. Gino won 13 of them with his Huskies at UConn. Summit won 9. Gino's winning percentage overall is .877. Pat Summit's was .841. And title game appearances, again, as I mentioned, Pat Summit's teams won 8 out of 13 title game appearances, and Gino Auriemma is actually 11 for 11. They are, without question, the two greatest coaches in the history of sports. So the focus is on Pat Summit for what reason? Because she just passed? No. Because Gino Auriemma came in, and Gino Auriemma has been doing some amazing things in a sport made amazing by what the legendary Pat Summit, by every measure, had built. And again, she didn't do it alone. She would never claim, her family would never claim, the Tennessee Volunteers would never claim she did it alone. But she was the most important cog in that wheel, if you will. And then sadly, the last thing to report about her, and we want to take some phone calls on this too, and I really want guys too. If you're like me, and I just described us kind of in a loose way, that we as guys, you know, we like guys' sports, we don't like women's sports as much. And that's not to be sexist, it's not to be gender discriminatory in any way. It's just a matter of, for entertainment purposes, we grew up watching the NBA, and the women's game is a below-the-rim game for the most part, 99% of the time. It's not as high-flying. It's not as athletic. There is no women's football game that we can watch. There is no equivalent baseball league, even though there is softball, somewhat professional, and then, of course, college. None of it matters the same way that the male game does. So we're predisposed, I think, to just kind of be drawn to men's games, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. We don't have to apologize for that. But I would just like the perspective of guys on Pat Summit. Did she and her Tennessee Vols teams draw your attention to the women's game, at least for a little while? Especially in the 1990s, it did for me. It really, really did. Now, if there was Tennessee on one channel, a women's game, especially if it was a big game, and if it was, I don't know, Duke and North Carolina on another channel, would I watch Tennessee over Duke and North Carolina? No. But would I flip in and check on it during commercial breaks, if no other time? You better believe I would. And I can't say that about any other woman's team or coach. I wouldn't really care. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. It's just obviously a very sad time. And by the way, the other part about this that makes it so incredibly difficult to deal with is the way she died. She didn't die. You know, Buddy Ryan, after a long and full life, not that there is any sort of an end date that should be on anybody's life, of course. It is tragic at any time, but, you know, Buddy Ryan, of course, died at the age of 82 after a long, full life, and God willing, I'll get 82 years. God willing. I mean, I'd love to get to 102. We all would. But by comparison, again, Pat Summit was taken at 64 after dealing with one of the most cruel diseases, I guess is the best way to say it, that you ever want to think of somebody dealing with, particularly if it happens to be someone you're close to, a family member, et cetera. Pat Summit suffering from early onset dementia, which is a part of Alzheimer's, not being able to care for herself, not being able to recognize people, not being able to do the things that made her what she was to so many for so long. That kind of thing also just kind of adds to the horrible sadness of this this moment for her family and those who loved her. So Pat Summit passes at the age of 64, far too young, obviously, and the prayers and the outpouring of support for her and for Hamley it's coming from around the country, from around the sports world and beyond, and it should. And I want to spend as much time as possible talking about her, and we will do so. By the way, very interesting coming up, and I'm very happy to be able to do this. We're going to talk coming up at about 4:05 with the voice of Tennessee basketball, the Tennessee Lady Vols basketball. And that is very, very cool because the voice happens to be a program director with one of our sister stations down in that area. And the program director is indeed Mickey Dearstone, the voice of the Lady Vols, worked with Pat Summitt for so many years, knew her very, very well, and is going to talk to us about her and her impact and her legacy and so on and so forth. So Mickey Dearstone is going to join us down there from Tennessee coming up in about a half an hour, about 35 minutes or so. So we're going to take a time out here at the bottom of the hour. We're going to come back in, going to talk a little bit more about Buddy Ryan, going to talk a little bit more about Pat Summitt. We're also going to talk a little baseball and a little NBA free agency, too. We don't want this to be a complete downer of a show as we talk about this cruel, cruel disease that takes this icon way too soon. We want to pay our proper respects and acknowledge who she was and what she was for the sport of women's college basketball. But we also want to talk about moving forward. And guess what? There's a lot to move forward on. NBA free agency starts on Friday. Kevin Durant has got six teams that he is apparently going to consider. He's going to be meeting with and thinking about how to best pursue and try to obtain his first championship as a pro, something he certainly deserves after being one of the greatest players of his generation. And he's obviously in his late 20s. It's time to get that going for him. So where is he going to go? Is he going to leave Oklahoma State? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I mentioned already, obviously, baseball. The Indians won their 10th straight by taking care of the Atlanta Braves last night down in Atlanta, something they hope to do for the next two. They're one of the worst teams in baseball, are the Braves. The Indians playing the hottest, of course, of any team, not just in the league right now or not just in the majors right now, but of anybody in the majors this season. Their winning streak, their percentage, everything that they're doing right now is the hottest streak anybody has had all season. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Tigers trying to bounce back. They take on the Marlins, obviously, so we'll get into that a little bit. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about besides the sadness of the passing of Pat Summitt and Buddy Ryan, but we're going to get all of that in. Want you to be a part of those conversations. I'll throw two quickies out at you as we go into the break. If you'd like to talk about this from a let's-do-comparison standpoint, which is completely appropriate given the legacies of these two late coaching monsters. Number one, do you agree with those who have said for the last 30-plus years that the 1985 Bears defense built and coached by Buddy Ryan is the greatest defense of all time? Do you agree with that? We'll take that, and if not, whose was? Do you go to those 2000 Ravens or those 2001, 2002, or I guess it was 0203, Tampa Bay Buccaneers? Do you look at the Pittsburgh Steelers of 74-75? The Purple People Eaters from the Vikings, the fearsome foursome? Rams, who do you look at? Where do you find the greatest defense of all time? Was it Buddy Ryan's, or was that just because they did the Super Bowl shuffle and Mike Ditka was so popular and Fridge and all that stuff? And then from Pat Summitt's standpoint, this is more than just women's college basketball. There would be no other name you could answer if I said who was better. You would say maybe Gino Auriemma, and then that's it. And that's certainly a matter of opinion, too. But how about this? Can you name another person of influence in the sports world who had as much influence on their sport as Pat Summitt did on hers? And that could be anybody really in any of the major sports that you talk about. But, I mean, when you talk about true iconic influences on their game, Pat Summitt is going to be at or near the top. Look, let me throw this at you, too. Greeny mentioned this morning, too, so I'll share it. The only four people associated with basketball to ever be given the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The Presidential Medal of Freedom is the highest honor that any civilian in the United States can receive. And it's something that is awarded only basically on the, at the judgment of the president. And in history, the only four basketball-related individuals to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom are John Wooden, Bill Russell, Dean Smith, and Pat Summitt. So if that puts her into some company that she belongs in, if that kind of gives you that perspective, Well, then I'm glad to offer that to you. All right, let's take a time out here. We'll get to the bottom of the hour Sports Center, and we're also going to give away some tickets when we come back. We have a lot of other fun stuff to do as well, while also paying appropriate respects to the legacies of Pat Summitt and Buddy Ryan as we continue. Want you to be a part. It's 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, that's who we are, that's what we are, that's where we are, right here, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks for being a part of the show. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Let's get you on the air to be a part of the show. 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. If you would like to be heard but can't wait on hold, you can also tweet to us at Sports Radio 106.5 on Twitter, and you may message us on Facebook at 106.5 The Ticket as well. Talking about a couple of very, very sad stories today. Obviously, the passing of Pat Summitt, the legendary Tennessee head coach. The Lady Vols were built. College basketball was built in large part because of the efforts of Pat Summitt. And I take nothing away from anybody else who had a big, big hand in this, but I don't think anybody is saying this simply because she passed away. They're saying this because of the footprint that she left. In fact, her greatest rival, as mentioned, the only coach with more national championships in college basketball history, women's basketball history, than she has, Gino Auriemma from UConn, of course, the legendary UConn program built by Gino Auriemma. You know, it was built a bit after Pat Summitt actually built women's college basketball in large part. And this is what he had to say in a SportsCenter interview about the great Pat Summitt.
What did Pat Summitt mean to you?
Well, I mean, I think when you compete against somebody, you probably see them in a different light than you would otherwise. So from a competitive standpoint, it was the one program, the one game that you each year you kind of measured yourself and your team that, hey, when we play that game, we'll know whether or not we're good enough to win a national championship or not. But from a personal standpoint, I mean, I think you can see, you know, how difficult it was back then for a woman to try to do something that really no one had ever done before, and no one thought you could do it, and trying to juggle being a mom and being a coach.
All right, looks like we got a technical glitch here with the audio. Apologies for that. I'll try to get that restored if I'm able to do so. But obviously you can hear it in his voice, you know, the sadness, but also the profound respect, even in, you know, the news of her passing that, you know, Auriemma was conveying to Pat Summitt as everyone reacts to that terrible news today. The other news, as mentioned, and I really certainly do not want to give any short shrift whatsoever to Buddy Ryan, to NFL fans, to certainly the Ryan family. Obviously, Rob Ryan, his son, has gone on to become a defensive coordinator for many, 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 many teams in the National Football League. None of them nearly as successful as Buddy Ryan's Chicago Bears teams. Built behind his 46 defense, the famed 46 defense in 1985. Obviously, Rex Ryan, his other son, head coach with the Jets for so many years, now head coach of the Buffalo Bills. Certainly, he has left his imprint on the game of football. There's something about Buddy Ryan, just to kind of give this a little bit more attention to, that I found very, very fascinating. And Cushlin, did you watch the 30 for 30 on the 1985 Bears?
Yes, I did.
The letter that the players from his old team, from that 85 Bears team, read from their coach, Buddy Ryan, their defensive coach, on that special, on that 30 for 30 special, was just something. I mean, it had them fighting back tears as they tried to read it. Ryan wrote this letter to his players recently. Obviously, he was in poor health at the time, and of course, he died today. He was unable to attend any of the reunion festivities surrounding the premiere of the documentary earlier last year. If you recall, of course, it was the 85 Bears, so in 2015 last year it was the anniversary. And so there were reunions and all kinds of other celebrations of the 85 Bears team. Buddy Ryan couldn't be there, so he wrote a letter to them, and here's the transcript of that letter, which was signed Coach Buddy Ryan 46. That's how he signed it, Coach Buddy Ryan 46. And this is what the players read during that 30 for 30 special. It was so so emotional. To my guys, in 1981, many of you signed a letter to George Halas to save my job. Now I'm writing a letter to all of you to say thanks. I wish I could be there to say it in person, but this will have to do. Thank you to the Super Bowl champion, 1985 Chicago Bears, the greatest football team in NFL history. You gave me the best memories of my coaching life. You all mean the world to me. I love every one of you until the day I die. I told you this a long time ago, and it's still true. You guys will always be my heroes. Love, Coach Buddy Ryan, 46. So that was what he said to his players, and that's what he meant to them. And it's so funny because, you know, when's the last time you heard of an assistant coach getting almost as much attention for his team's accomplishments as the team's head coach, especially when the head coach is as iconic as Mike Ditka? I mean, Mike Ditka and his Bears spawned the entire Saturday Night Live, you know, sketch, the long time often repeated, you know, series of sketches, including the super fans, you know, the whole Ditka Bears and the whole thing. I mean, Mike Ditka was responsible for that. Mike Ditka is quite obviously just, you know, a legend in the game. And he was the winning coach of the 1985 Super Bowl. He built the Chicago Bears. He used that defense, combined it with a running game featuring Walter Payton, one of the greatest players in the history of the sport. A passing game that was never as prolific as some of the others of that era, the Dan Marino Dolphins, you know, the Dan Fouts Chargers, and obviously in today's NFL, the way the passing games are, but still a very, very threatening offense because of the speed of Willie Gault and the guile of Jim McMahon. It was just it was Mike Ditka's team. And yet when people think back to the 85 Bears, at least football people, they go back and they give almost as much credit and maybe as much credit to Buddy Ryan as they do to Mike Ditka. You just don't see that very often. But that's what we have here, and I find it kind of fascinating, to be honest with you, that that's the way it is. But Buddy Ryan had that kind of impact building that 46 defense that, well, you read the letter, or I'm sorry, you heard the letter that I just read to you, that 46 defense that is regarded by some, including obviously Buddy himself, as the greatest defense of all time, the anchor of the greatest football team in the history of the sport. That's the way Buddy, you know, is, you know, went to his grave thinking about it, and that's the way so many other people do as well. Now, I want to go ahead and share with you just a couple of words from Mike Ditka on his former coach. I shared some things from Buddy Ryan already, obviously. But this is from Mike and Mike this morning, Greenberg and Golic, although Golic was not there again. Russillo and Cannell were in for him. But Mike Ditka, on the morning show that you hear each and every day right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, such a big part of the reason why we love being a part of ESPN Radio, because of that, the best morning show on all of sports radio. But this is Mike Ditka reflecting a little bit on his former defensive coordinator and friend who died at the age of 82 today. I want you to give this a quick listen.
Sad day. The legendary head coach of those Bears we were just talking about, the Hall of Famer, Mike Ditka, is with us. Coach, thanks for getting up early, and we're so sorry to be calling with the sad news. We will give you the floor. What are your thoughts today on the passing of Buddy Ryan?
Mike, I just picked up my phone and saw a message from you, the call you got. I know I had heard nothing. I mean, I went to bed early last night, and I slept, and I went down and worked out. So I do all the things I normally do. I had no idea. I knew the last time I saw Buddy, I knew he wasn't doing real well. I know his memory was starting to fail him a little bit. The 85 Bears would not have been the 85 Bears without Buddy Ryan. You know, Mike Ditka is Mike Ditka. You know, I had an opportunity. I was hired by Mr. Halas. And when he was hired, he told me, he said, I want you to keep Coach Ryan. He's a defensive coordinator. And I said, fine. You know, they did what Buddy wanted to do on defense. And fortunately, we were good enough to get to a point where our offense could complement some of the things that they did on defense. you know, there's no question. We won the Super Bowl because of our defense. I mean, you know, you'd have to be a fool to say otherwise. We had great players on offense in Walter Payton and Willie Gault and some of the other guys we had, and we had a wonderful offensive line. But our defense is why we won. And Buddy was he was very stubborn in the fact that he was not going to get away from playing that defense he wanted to play. And that was it, you know. He wasn't going to play any 4-3. He was going to play the Bear defense, and that's what it was going to be. And when you started breaking it down, what they were doing, and other teams broke it down a little bit, what he had is 8 minutes of line of scrimmage. And then, therefore, you had to discern who the heck was coming after you. And basically, that's what they did. So, you know, people started spreading it out a little bit, and they tried to find some weaknesses in it. But then again, it comes down to not only was the philosophy of playing the defense great, but the personnel was good. So when you have those two things going, you got something pretty good.
And Buddy Ryan used it to its maximum effect. Sorry about the audio quality of some of this from this morning on Mike and Mike, but I did want you to just hear Mike Ditka admit what so many others have said. Look, yeah, I was the coach, but Buddy Ryan did what Buddy Ryan wanted to do with that defense, and I didn't try to get in his way. Yeah, we put together a nice offense, and we had some star caliber players, and we had, you know, Willie Gault and Walter Payton and Jim McMahon and a really great offensive line. But let's be real, we won that championship because of Buddy Ryan and because of our defense. And nobody knew where the next blitz was coming from. Nobody knew where anybody was going to be lined up. What kind of pre-snap adjustments were going to be made by the defense? I mean, what Buddy Ryan's 46 defense did was very similar, and tell me if you agree or disagree with this, and Jim Cushion, you can answer too. It was very similar to his defense did what Peyton Manning has been doing on offenses for the last 20 years, up until, of course, retiring after the Super Bowl. And that is looking and seeing what is there and then calling plays at the line, changing everything in order to take advantage of the weakness as he sees it. That's what Buddy Ryan's defense did. Buddy Ryan's defense could come at you from so many different places with so many disguised blitzes, so many disguised, you know, run defenses versus pass coverages and so on, that pre-snap they were making adjustments and changes thanks to the brilliant Mike Singletary, of course, the captain in the middle of that defense with those big, wide, giant, wide eyes staring, you know, straight ahead and intimidating everybody.
Who, by the way, if you recall in that 30 for 30 that you referenced with the letter that you read, yeah. he was one who literally said, I can't read this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's how emotional he was over it. And, you know, the way they played defense for that team, obviously, it was unlike really anything anybody had seen quite before. Now, does that mean it was the single greatest defense of all time? I guess anybody has an opinion on that. You really do have to kind of say, well, it wasn't the greatest for a period of time. It might have been the greatest for that season, but that's a different discussion than the greatest defense for a period of time. And you got to go again, like we talked about, to the period of 1974, roughly to 1979-80, with the Pittsburgh Steelers, the heyday of the Steel Curtain, with how many Hall of Famers on that team. You know, you go there. But for a single season, there aren't a whole lot of other teams, I guess, that you can really make this case for. But just for the sake of discussion, the NFL did this on NFL.com, at least Gil Brandt, working for NFL.com, NFL senior analyst, just literally, Jim, 3 months ago, 4 months ago. How many was it till February? Yeah, 4 months ago. This was just on NFL.com 4 months ago. Gil Brandt identifying for NFL.com the five best defenses of all time for a single season. And the five that he identified were, in reverse order, number five, the 1986, 1 year after, believe it or not, 1986 New York Giants. They allowed 297 yards a game, which was second, 14.8 points per game. And they, of course, were anchored by Lawrence Taylor, who is first-team All-World and will be forever. We won't get into any of the personal stuff there. Hall of Famer Harry Carson, also in the middle. Outside linebacker Carl Banks. They didn't have a ton of shutdown corners or you know, outstanding defensive linemen. But the way they played the game and the way they let their linebackers dictate offensive flow was really kind of unprecedented, maybe to that point. So the fifth best team of all time defensively, according to NFL.com and Gil Brandt, the 1986 Giants. The fourth best defense of all time for a single season. Very recent, just 3 years ago. The Seattle Seahawks. The 2013 Seahawks gave up just 273 yards a game, which was first in the league, 14.4 points a game, which was first in the league. And this team is this high, according to Gil Brandt, because of the degree of difficulty of being the dominant defense in the current era of pure offense. The Seahawks gave up a league-low 231 points. They had the best overall and passing defense. They had 28 interceptions, and they didn't do it the way, you know, some of these other teams did, like we'll talk about with the Bears. They didn't blitz very much. They relied on linebackers, Bobby Wagner, and defensive backs, Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas against the run, and, you know, Thomas and Richard Sherman against the pass, too, to shut everybody down. And they made their mark in the playoffs, obviously. The mark of a great defense, the sign of a great defense, the ability to make critical stops when they had to be made, and that's exactly what they did when they stopped comeback attempts by the Saints in the divisional round, then the Niners in the NFC title game, and then they dominated the Broncos in the Super Bowl, obviously. So you got the 86 Giants, then the 2013 Seahawks. Brings us to the third best defense of all time, according to NFL.com, for a single season. Again, a recent team in a passing, incredibly type of offensive game, overemphasized is what I want to say, offensive game. It was last year, the 2015 Broncos, who just won the Super Bowl in February. They gave up 283 yards a game, first in the league, 18 points a game, fourth in the league, but the Broncos defense single-handedly won Super Bowl 50. The offense was outgained in the playoffs, couldn't muster up more than 200 yards against the Panthers in the Super Bowl, but the Broncos held all three playoff opponents to a combined total of 44 points, less than 15 points a game scored by offenses, including those quarterbacked by Ben Roethlisberger, Tom Brady, and Cam Newton. The Steelers and Patriots, very good teams. The Panthers, of course, were nearly undefeated in the regular season and led the NFL in scoring, and all Denver did was shut them all down enough to win, obviously, going away, essentially, in the playoffs. So as he pointed out, you know, Von Miller, of course, the MVP of the Super Bowl, was just ridiculous. But Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware, they had three shutdown corners, Aqib Talib, Chris Harris, and Bradley Roby, and a defensive line that was so versatile stopping the run, like Sylvester Williams, Derek Wolfe, and Malik Jackson. So that was your number three all-time defensive team, according to NFL.com. The second, I mentioned it right at the top of the show when we started talking about Buddy Ryan, the 2000 Ravens. They allowed 247 yards per game, which was second, and 10 points per game, which was first, which is incredible. They had Hall of Fame safety Rod Woodson, and, of course, Hall of Famer to be Ray Lewis. But the group didn't have a ton of big-name players other than those guys. Rather, they played as a unit. They were the driving engine of Baltimore's run to that Super Bowl, considering the offense really had nothing to be threatening except for Jamal Lewis. They were quarterbacked by Trent Dilfer, as everyone knows, not exactly a Hall of Fame caliber quarterback. They didn't have really stars anywhere, but they just had a defense. Especially since, Brian Billick was an offensive-minded head coach, but the defensive staff, Marvin Lewis, of course, was the coordinator. It's where he built his name. Rex Ryan was the defensive line coach. Jack Del Rio was the linebackers coach. And Mike Smith was the defensive assistant coach. All of them went on to have success as head coaches and currently still with teams today. So that was the second, and then, of course, the first. There it is, as designated by NFL.com, the greatest single-season defense of all time was the 1984 Bears. First in the league with 258 yards allowed per game. First in points allowed, just 12.4 points allowed. Bill Parcells said this was the best defense he ever faced in all of his years coaching. The Bears trampled offenses in the regular season before going on an astonishing playoff run in which they shut out the Giants 21-0, shut out the Rams 24-0, then beat the Patriots by 36 points in Super Bowl 20, and they held New England to seven, count them, seven rushing yards. That was Buddy Ryan's defense. The line with ends Dan Hampton and Richard Dent, the linebackers, Mike Singletary and Otis Wilson, the safeties just rocking people, Dave Dorsch and Gary Fensick. They were unbelievable. So there you go. Buddy Ryan identified his team as the greatest of all time, and at least on the defensive side of the ball, NFL.com would concur. And by the way, one quick note for those who might argue, they note in this story, they considered the 74 Pittsburgh Steelers and the 2002 Tampa Bay Buccaneers that I mentioned, but those units finished just outside of NFL.com's top five, and there's a debate to be had there. All right, we're going to get out now because it is 3:58 on the way into the timeout. I want to give away something cool. I did this yesterday. I want to do it again because golf is coming back to Sylvania at Highland Meadows. The Marathon Classic runs July 11 to July 17, and I've got a couple of four-packs of tickets to the Classic. If you would like them, be caller 10 or caller 11. I'll give away a four-pack to each. Callers 10 and 11 at 866-240-1065, and we will send you to Highland Meadows in Sylvania. On the other side of the Sports Center here at the top of the hour, we are going to talk with Mickey Dearstone, who is the play-by-play voice of the Tennessee Lady Vols for so many years. Obviously known Pat Summitt so very closely, and we're going to hear some stories and talk about the impact of the late Pat Summitt as we continue the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.
Starting pitcher for the Indians, Trevor Bauer, making his 12th start, 5-2 record.
Strikes it out on the swing.
Good pitch.
Good pitch. That rung him up. Two down. And I mean Bauer just ate him up with a two-seam fastball that ran in on his knuckles. I believe it. Lonnie Chisenhall launches one deep to right.
How
back
about
is
it?
Markakis. He's out of room. It's out of here. A three-run homer for Lonnie Chisenhall. And the Indians jump out to a 4-1 lead here in the fourth.
And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of crowd that stood up. They get greedy.
Uh-oh. Deep right. Back goes Markakis. Still going back. He makes the catch. No, drops the ball. Coming around third, Ramirez. He is flying. And he will score easily in the second as Naquin. It's 7-2.
I think Mike took a job because he wanted a head job, and, you know, he had to accept me. There's no question. Mr. House already hired me. I hired my defensive coaches. I was a defensive coach. I tried to be nice and do the things the way they're supposed to be done, but I think Mike had a hard time adjusting. Sure, I want to coach in the National Football League. I want to be head. I tried to get one job, and that, they had all kinds of rumors, assistant job and everything else, but I only tried to get one job, and that was a Tampa Bay job. I had the most fun in Philadelphia I've had in all my coaching. Everybody thought, man, that was tough. It wasn't tough. Hell, you know, I enjoy tough situations, I guess, because we really had a lot of fun.
I love what I do, so that's my motivation. My motivation is working with young people and going back to trying to help them be successful. I mean, I don't have to coach another day in my life. I don't have to win another game. I don't have anything that I feel like, hey, I've got to prove this. I got to stay in the game and prove this. I love working with these young women and helping them strive to be the best they can be.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, the extravaganza rolls into hour number two at 4:11, a little bit later than we like, but thanks for being a part of the program. Mike Miller, Drive Time, coming your way at 5 o'clock. A lot of topics on the table. You just heard several of them in the top of the hour montage. Indians continue to be the hottest team in baseball. 10 straight wins, looking for 11 tonight. And Corey Kluber's on the mound. Is it Kluber tonight?
Yeah, it's Kluber tonight.
Corey Kluber tonight. Indians and Atlanta Braves should be number 11 in a row, but you know how baseball can be. Tigers getting back at it, by the way, against the Marlins tonight. So we've got a little baseball going on. We've got a lot of NBA to talk about as well. The passing of Buddy Ryan, we just spent a great deal of time on in the last half hour, but I want to return now to what we started our program with, and that is the passing of the legendary coach of the University of Tennessee Lady Volunteers. And when I say legendary, I say that word with all of the respect that it should reflect. And what I mean is there are a lot of people who can become legendary for being great coaches, but it means something entirely different to become legendary for being a great ambassador and indeed a designer, a builder, a creator of the sport. in women's college basketball was virtually unknown before Pat Summitt got her first job at the University of Tennessee. When she started coaching, my goodness gracious, it wasn't a thing. Young people today know about women's college basketball. They know about Gino Auriemma. They know about UConn's records and everything else. But the sport was built in large part by the hands of Pat Summitt. And her passing at the very, very young age of 64 due to perhaps one of the cruelest diseases that one can imagine, robbing her of her sense of self and so many other things that she was so noted for. That is why we mourn her passing today, but we also celebrate her accomplishments. And joining us now to do some of that celebration is somebody who knew her very, very well as the play-by-play voice for the Tennessee Lady Vols for many, many years, known Pat Summitt very, very closely, and is as qualified as anybody to talk about her as a person and her impact on women's college basketball. Mickey Dearstone joins us now right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Mickey, good afternoon. Thank you very much for the time. I know it's a tough day, so I won't ask you how you're doing, but I will ask you how you're holding up at the loss of your friend.
Well, I'll be honest with you. This is probably about number 13 on the interview list today, and I want to thank everybody because it really has helped me to talk about it and to kind of go back and think of some of the funny things and the good things and things like that. So it's kind of helped me, and I have no problem at all being on with you this afternoon.
Well, we really appreciated it. My goodness, you are, you've got to be going hoarse after 12 interviews, and now we're going to subject you to one more. So I really appreciate you spending the time with us. Let's start with the beginning as far as your relationship with Pat. When did you start working for the Lady Vols and calling games, and when did you have your first exposure to Coach Summitt?
About 22 years ago, almost 23 years ago this fall, was the first time that I ever really had any contact at all with Pat Summitt. I worked in radio, non-sports radio before then, so I knew who she was and I knew what she was doing for Lady Vol basketball at the old gym at Stokely Center. And so I knew all of that, but it was about 23 years ago the first time that I ever did a game and had an interaction with her.
So your first impression then, I mean, I would have to imagine, given, what she had already been in terms of growing the program and growing the sport and everything else, that she was probably a bit of an intimidating figure just simply from her presence for you to meet for the first time. How did that go?
I wonder how you knew that, because not too long ago, before she stepped down as the coach and was diagnosed, she asked me one day on a road trip, she said, so how have you put up with me all these years? And I said, well, to be frank with you, the first 10 years, you scared the hell out of me. And I just wanted to make sure that I didn't make you mad and I did a good enough job that you would let me come back the next game. And she just horse laughed. She thought that was the funniest thing she'd ever heard before. But she was an intimidating figure. And the reason it was intimidating was because of her work ethic and how serious she was about the job that she was hired to do. And, you know, once I got a chance to do things and talk to her off the court and out of the office, you know, at dinner on road trips and stuff like that, then we kind of developed a friendship that I wouldn't trade for anything.
Mickey, you say that she kind of laughed, with that horse laugh that you were afraid of her. Did she know that she was as intimidating as she came off to people, or was it intentional and she's just kind of, being a little bit understated when she acknowledges it?
Well, I think, honestly, that she thought that there was something wrong with me. She goes, you being afraid of me? And I said, yeah, that comes from so much respect. But your everyday person, your Lady Vol fans, they never really experienced that because she was so engaging with everyone, every fan, every person that she ran into. She did her own grocery shopping and stuff, and she had talked to anybody that came up to her and approached her. And she was just a normal, everyday person when she wasn't in the office or on the basketball court. And that was the thing that made her so special, is she never saw a stranger, and she never thought that she was better than anybody that came up to her. And there's very few people you can say that about.
And yet it was, well, and I guess not and yet, but it's because of the fact that so many people's exposure to her was only what they saw on that sideline during games. And it's that sideline presence that I think would make people think that, oh, my gosh, I'm intimidated. That glare, as a matter of fact, among the many, many tributes and remembrances and recollections of Pat Summitt's career that are all over the, you know, the news and sports websites, et cetera, today, there's a piece on ESPN.com in which her former players try to describe and try to imitate her stare. It's that steely-eyed stare straight at the court, whether it was at a player, an official, an opponent, or whatever it was, that just made everybody kind of freeze in their tracks like, uh-oh, coach is looking at me. That's the kind of look that she was known for.
I got it one time. I know exactly what you're talking about there. She always called me by my last name, Deerstone, and that was because when I started, Mickey DeMoss was an assistant coach. So when she yelled for Mickey, both of us would answer, and she got tired of that. So from then on, she started calling me Deerstone. And I went to practice one day, and she said, "What's up, Deerstone?" And I said, "Not much, Summit." She didn't say a word. She went just as quiet as everything and just kind of turned her head slowly and gave me that stare. And I immediately apologized and promised I would never do that again.
Now, please tell me that she began laughing after that.
No, she didn't.
No.
I wished I could, but no, she did. We laughed about it later, but not at that time. She wanted me to call her. She wanted me to call her Pat or Coach Summit, and that's what I did from then on.
And I don't blame you one bit. We're talking with Mickey Deerstone, the 22-year play-by-play voice of the Tennessee Lady Vols, of course, reflecting on the career of Pat Summitt. You know, the numbers anybody can do, and we've done them like everybody else, 1,098 and 208, which is just insane in 38 years, the 8 national titles, the 18 Final Fours. What was, and I know this is it's a tough question to answer when I say what was her secret. There is no secret, obviously. It's hard work, et cetera. But, I mean, a lot of people work hard and don't win 8 national championships. A lot of people work hard and don't win over 1,000 games. So it's more than just hard work and dedication, et cetera. What made her such a dynamic, successful coach season after season, you know, with a roster, obviously, that turns over every year with graduations and new kids coming in, and it just never missed a beat?
Well, the one thing she did as part of her hard work was that she made a lot of effort in figuring out personalities of the kids that she brought into this program. And she had this ability to motivate based on a kid's personality. In other words, she knew exactly how much tough love they could stand. She knew how many people needed more tough love than others. And she coached them that way. And there's a lot of coaches that work as hard as she did that didn't go that far to figure out the personalities and the type of kid that she had playing for them. And so that was what set her apart. And that, along with the fact that she would play anybody, anywhere, anytime for the betterment of women's college basketball. And she did that.
You know, the it's kind of interesting you say that. One of the quotes that I read today that kind of stuck out for me as I've looked at all the coverage, Candace Parker, who, of course, was the star of her 07 and 08 national championship teams, she said that no matter who needed her, whether it was her, Candace, meaning, you know, a star-type player, to the last person on the bench to a team manager, she knew everybody by name and treated them all as if they were her own. And that was what made her so endearing. While everybody might be intimidated by the stare, the look, the stoic facade that she put on the sideline, that she had a heart as big as an ocean for anybody that was, you know, that was a part of her program.
Yeah, Candace is exactly right. We actually talked to one of her former managers at this morning. That's a good friend of Candace Parker. She was telling stories about, you know, how Pat handled them, but then how, when their 4 years were over as managers for the Lady Vols program, how all of a sudden it changed from being more of a mother instead of a boss. And, you know, she said that she wouldn't be the person she is today without Pat Summitt. And she didn't play for her. She just kind of worked for her as far as a manager is concerned.
When we talk about Pat Summitt's impact on those lives, and that's a great story, and what Candace said is a great story. She obviously had a much bigger impact than just on the players who wore the orange that she coached. And people have talked about how she helped build the sport. She came in, if I heard it right this morning, 2 years after Title IX became law, and women's sports were guaranteed the same types of opportunities as men's sports, et cetera. But obviously she didn't come in with everything being even. She had to work to make it that way, and that she was one of the most influential builders of the game, of the women's game, not only from her time, but for all time. Can you talk a little bit more to that, what she meant to the development, the growth, and the and just essentially the expansion of the women's college game?
Yeah, Paul Feinbaum on ESPN, the SEC Network, said yesterday, I think it was, that no other coach has had such a lasting impact on their sport as much as Pat Summitt did. And, yes, you get into Title IX, you get into politics and stuff like that, you get into equal opportunities for women, that always turns political. But she always did it without carrying around signs. She did it by influencing young girls and letting them know that it was okay to be an athlete. If you could be an athlete, you could still be a refined young woman. You could still be a refined woman after you got out of school. And that's how she went about it. Her thinking was that if you taught young kids that it was okay, then they're going to grow up, they're going to teach their kids that it's okay, and then it's like about anything else, really political, to be honest with you. If you start with the young kids, then that's where it is, because grown-ups sometimes don't change their mind.
We're talking about Pat Summitt. We're trying to celebrate the life while also, of course, grieving and sending prayers and condolences and warm thoughts to her family and to the entire Tennessee Volunteer family and anybody who knew Pat very well. Mickey Dearstone is among those who did, the play-by-play voice of the Tennessee Lady Vols, on his 13th interview today discussing Pat's career. Tell us something, Mickey, that we would not know about her. And it can be an individual story. It was kind of a cute one that you told when you called her by her last name. But tell us something that people who have watched the game for so long and who know about her and her accomplishments, but they do not know about her.
All right. I've got a story that I've got to tell you, and I tell this a lot of times when I do speaking engagements and stuff, that we were coming back from a charter flight from a road trip one night, and they're small planes, and there's only one flight attendant. The door shut, and they were getting ready to take off. And the flight attendant all of a sudden just broke down, just sobbing. Well, Pat always sat in the first two seats on the left, and she saw it. And she gets up, and she goes and puts her arm around this girl and asks her if she's okay and what the problem was. Well, when the flight attendant finally composed herself, she looked at Pat, and she said, "You don't remember me." She goes, "But after Louisiana Tech down in Ruston, Louisiana, beat you a couple years ago, I was in the handicapped section in a wheelchair when you walked out of the gym to go back to the dressing room." And she said, "Even after a loss, you stopped, you kneeled down, and you talked to me and told me that if I worked hard and had the right attitude, that I could do anything I wanted to do, including walk again." And she ended up walking again and was a flight attendant on one of her flights. And that story right there always told me how just any individual that she talked to, she touched them in a special way.
Wow. That is an amazing look at her. And again, and I hate to sound like a broken record here, but you look at that stoic, you know, appearance on the sideline, you look at somebody who's just hard and dedicated to her craft and focused and laser locked in on the mission at hand. And after a loss, a rare loss, 208 of them in 38 years, you would think that she is about the last person you want to talk to. And for her to give that type of time and attention in the way you just described, that is something for which I'm sure she and her family members would like her to be known as much as any championship trophy she ever hoisted.
Yeah, I agree.
Mickey, last thing, and this is the difficult part, as, again, we celebrate her life, but we talk about the the cruel disease that ended up taking it. You know, you mentioned the story you just told. The flight attendant said, "You don't remember me," and a little bit of foreshadowing there, because at the end, that's what this disease does. It robs people of the ability to remember a lot of things about themselves, about their surroundings, about their loved ones, etc. Can you speak to, I don't know how much interaction you had with her since her retirement and since she, you know, began dealing with the early onset dementia and the Alzheimer's that she did?
It's a very cruel disease for anyone, and family members of people that have that. Only about 5% of the 5 million plus that are dealing with Alzheimer's today have early onset dementia. It hits you earlier. And not only is it unfair to those people, but I've always had a problem getting over the fact of how unfair it is for Pat. Because you have a woman that is an icon that has accomplished so much, and she left this world as we know it, not remembering any of it. And that's just how cruel this disease is. And I urge people to go to the Pat Summit Foundation and make a donation, whether it's $1, $5, $10, $100. It doesn't matter, because we've got to find something to battle this disease.
The Pat Summit Foundation, is it just what it sounds like? Would it be patsummitfoundation.com, or just Google it up for folks?
It's patsummitfoundation.org.
.org. Okay, I'm glad that I asked.
Yes.
If I may, and by the way, I apologize for making you talk about this part. And again, you've been doing it so many times today. I'm certain it's it gets no easier each time that you do. Did oftentimes you'll hear about Alzheimer's patients, dementia patients, going through everything you just described, as cruelly as it is. But they sometimes come back and have moments of lucidity and they stave off the symptoms of the disease for a while, and the family and those who love that individual can kind of see her again and recognize and be recognized. Did she have some of that, at least as she battled this down to the end?
No, I wish I could say she did, but it was a gradual decline. And I honestly think that it was maybe even a couple of years ago at the first and second rounds of the NCAA tournament at Thompson Bowling Arena that I felt like she knew who I was. And then it's just a gradual decline from there. There is nothing that slows it down. There is nothing that gets rid of it. All you can do is learn how to manage it. She had a lot of caretakers that helped her do that. Once you get it, then it's basically downhill from there.
Well, Mickey, I can't imagine what it feels like to have known somebody as well as you knew her for so long, and to have such a deep and profound respect for her as well as a friendship with her, to have it end in such a way. But I thank you so much for sharing the story with our audience, and obviously with audiences around the country today, as so many people want to pay respect to her and to celebrate her life and her career. I will tweet that out and send it out in any other way that I can, that Pat Summit Foundation website, to get some donations, as you point out, because it's the only way to stop this very cruel disease from taking so many other lives and robbing people of their identities in the way that it does. And if we can do so in her name, that is the best thing that we can do.
I'm sure the family and her close friends would appreciate that.
Absolutely. Mickey, thank you so much for sharing the story with us. And again, our condolences to you as well as every other close friend and family member on the loss of your loved one.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mickey. There's Mickey Dearstone, play-by-play voice of the Tennessee Volunteer Lady Vols. As he said, for 22 years, he knew Pat Summit very, very closely from working together, covering the games, actually broadcasting the games, obviously. And obviously very, very emotional to see such a tragic end to such an iconic figure. And I will tell you this, not that I need to, I'm sure you can feel it, and you heard it in his voice as well. That perhaps is the saddest thing about her death at the very young, tender age of 64, is the fact that she didn't go to her final resting place knowing who she was and knowing what an impact she had on so many. That is perhaps the cruelest part of the entire thing. Not that there's anything that would have been better I suppose the loss of you know, of a good person is the loss of a good person, but the fact that she was unable to appreciate how much she was appreciated, how about that? That she really didn't really get to the opportunity to know what she meant to so many people as she passed on. So we'll leave it at that. All right, if you've got thoughts and you would like to respond to or throw in your two cents about her and her place among the iconic coaches and performers at their craft in college or professional sports history, any of those types of things, I'd love to hear from you at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. It's just a really unbelievable story to try to share, and we're glad that Mickey Dearstone shared it with us. All right, we'll be right back after a Sports Center right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well, what a poignant conversation with Mickey, the longtime voice of Tennessee Volunteers basketball. Mickey Dearstone joined us. Who knew Pat Summitt for so many years. Just a very, very terrible time, obviously, for him and those close to him, and obviously close to Pat Summitt. Very emotional. A lot of that came through, and there's not much you can say about it other than it is indeed exactly what Mickey called it. It's the cruelest disease, a disease that robs someone of self and the ability to even recognize who they are and what they meant to so many other people. All right, I want to try to lift your spirits a little bit and try to talk about some other things, including some baseball and some basketball these last 20 minutes of the program. Mike Miller coming up with Drive Time. But first, let me remind you that if you're looking for ways to save money, especially when it comes to auto repairs, we've got the answer for you. It's LKQ Pick Your Part, where you can bring your own tools and pull the parts you need and save big. It's that easy. Parts from over 1,000 vehicles to choose from in a clean and organized lot at LKQ Pick Your Part. You can always find new inventory for your car or truck. Transmissions to tires and rims to radiators. Just visit LKQ Pick Your Part today and find the parts you need. They're always buying used vehicles as well. Call them up at 800-962-2277 if you've got a used vehicle for sale. You know, you can save up to 90% on your auto repairs when you do the work yourself. At LKQ Pick Your Part, you're doing the work, so you are enjoying the savings. If you like to work on your car and save money, visit LKQ Pick Your Part. And remember, at LKQ Pick Your Part, all parts are always guaranteed, always. It's on Hagman Road, just off East Alexis Road in Toledo. LKQ Pick Your Part. All right, what direction to go in? Jim Cushlin, first, any reaction before we do that to the passing of Coach Summitt? I know I've dominated the conversation with a lot of monologuing and a lot of stories and a lot of audio sound bites and an interview. Just your thoughts as a younger guy. I don't know how much of an opportunity you had to pay attention to her dominance as the championship coach that she was for so many years.
Well, from my standpoint, as a younger guy, you know, when I first heard, I'm not trying to be, you know, almost cruel when I say this, but when I first noticed there was such a thing as women's basketball, it was under the context of Pat Summitt and what she was doing at Tennessee. So for me, this would have been the early 90s, kind of when I would have even noticed that. And that, to me, is the biggest
takeaway. That's
when
she was dominating, too.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Yeah, that's when a lot of her titles happened.
Exactly. And, you know, her... In many ways, you know, everything you see in some respects for women's basketball today, and I mean college and the WNBA, it can trace back to things that Pat Summitt did to really start building that program and that sport in general, as you were mentioning, when she first got hired. What was that? What would that have been? Mid-70s, I guess?
Yeah, right. I think they said 74.
Right, okay, that makes sense. But in many ways, she helped really build not just Tennessee, but women's basketball, pro and college and pro, to what it kind of is today. And a lot of those things may not have been there without the contributions she made. So an absolute legend as far as women's basketball. And as a result, I personally still rank her a little over Ariema at UConn, even though Ariema has 8 titles to Summitt's 8, because
11-8.
11-8. Thank you. Because Pat Summitt was basically there at the beginning. I mean, you mentioned it perfectly. What was it, a year or two after Title IX, which allowed some of these sports to even get footholds in the first place at the various schools? And there she is taking the job. And, you know, among some of the cuts for the montage that I wasn't able to squeeze in there, she was talking about things like that. And early on, you know, I was the one wrapping the players' ankles. They used to hate it because I would wrap them too tight or something to that effect. And it just shows how much work and how much she put into not just Tennessee, but the game itself. And in a lot of ways, women's basketball today would not be what it was without her contribution at the beginning. So that's my thoughts when it comes to Pat Summitt in this regard.
I never really thought I would ever spend this much time talking about women's college basketball.
No kidding.
Of course, I never thought it would come to this. You know, and obviously not just her passing, but her passing at a young age, and not just that, but the way that it happened as well. I was always a fan, as I said, as much as I've been a fan of women's sports, not as much as men's, as most of us would agree. I was a fan of hers, and I was a fan of theirs. And I will tell you this, too. I am not a sexist, but I have never been really keen on the idea of women coaching men, particularly in things like football where women just don't play.
Sure.
Unless it's a very rare circumstance that you have somebody plays on a high school team or I don't know, maybe even a college team, but almost always they're kickers and it's not really their forte. But there was long, for really a couple of decades, many conversations. For a long time there were suggestions that why won't somebody offer Pat Summitt a job coaching the men? Why won't she, with all of her success, how could she not have a job coaching the men? And I always thought to myself, if anybody could ever do that, that is exactly who should do that. But you know what I think the answer was? I don't think she ever would have entertained such offers. I don't think she was trying to prove I'm as good as a men's coach, and because I'm coaching women, I'm not as good. I don't think she felt the need that I have to coach on the next level up, if you will, the higher level to validate my career, success, greatness, whatever it is that you want to call it. I don't think that was ever in her mindset. I don't think she was somebody who felt like, well, yeah, I won 8 championships with the girls. That's not like winning them the way John Wooden did with the boys, so I've got to coach them. I think if a school would have approached her and said, we'd like to talk to you about interviewing for our men's basketball job, I think she would have said, thank you, but no thank you. I'm coaching basketball. It doesn't matter to me what kind it is. That's just the impression that I get from watching her, listening to her. She was a champion for the sport, champion for girls. She wasn't some, you know, wild women's liber in that, you know, she resented male dominance of the sport, dominance of the media cycles regarding the sport and the kind of coverage that it got versus women. She wasn't one of those, you know, look at us, pay attention to us, you know, whiners in any kind of a way. She was just a strong, confident woman coaching young girls at the college level to be strong, confident women and to let their play generate the talk. Let their play generate the coverage. Let their play get them the TV opportunities. And that's what they did. And you know what? If you can do that and win over a guy like me, who, quite frankly, is not interested in the WNBA, not interested in women's golf, but I'll watch the PGA, not interested in women's softball, but I watch Major League Baseball, you can win over a guy like me. Then you can win over millions of guys like me, quite frankly, and I think she did that.
And I tend to agree that there might be a lot of truth to what you just said, and not only those kind of things, but remember, again, this is also couching it back in when she started, you know, the whole, not just that program, but the whole concept of women's sports were more or less starting from scratch in those days. And so, you know, you had to build the sport where it's competing with the men and yada yada wasn't a priority, wasn't something they probably even thought of, you know, in those kind of days. It's how can we make this kind of environment, this kind of setting, and all that goes with it good for the growing up, the maturation, and other such things of these young ladies. And to that, she did an outstanding job and paved the way for so many more to come down the line.
No question about it, and I don't know that there will. Well, in fact, I think I'm pretty safe in saying there will never be another one like her. But as you said, pave the way for others to work toward what she did. And no one else will get there, but working toward what she did, and we'll just kind of leave it at that. All right, I want to get into a couple of other things before we're done today. As I mentioned, big news in the NBA. Speaking of basketball, we've been talking about a lot with the Pat Summitt story, and again, our condolences to the family and friends and all of those who were very close to Buddy Ryan as well, who died at the age of 82 after battling an illness for quite some time. We spent a lot of time doing eulogies today, so I do want to close the show, at least the last segment or so, with some talk about what else is going on. And Kevin Durant continues to be the top story in the NBA right now. Free agency starting on Friday. Kevin Durant already announced he was going to have face-to-face talks with three clubs. The Thunder, his existing team, and he's played all 9 years of his career with that franchise, even though that goes back into Seattle.
Yeah, his rookie season was the final year of the Supersonics. I sometimes even forget that.
But the same franchise, obviously. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, you could argue that Kevin Durant built the Oklahoma City Thunder.
No question.
Not that, you know, they wouldn't have moved without him, but, I mean, with him, it made it a success immediately. He was must-see TV. He was must-go-and-buy season tickets. When they went from Seattle to Oklahoma City, he provided them instant credibility, instant viability. So in large part, if he leaves the Thunder, he'll be leaving the team that he built. And you know, when that, I mean, you know,
spun another way, the first year in Oklahoma City, which was Durant's second year in the league, is the only year the Thunder have had a losing season.
How about that? So yeah, and obviously as he's developed, you know, they've gotten better and better, came within one win of going to the NBA Finals, this season, obviously. But Kevin Durant essentially built that, and now the question is will he unbuild it by leaving? The three teams he was going to talk to, those Thunder, the Spurs, and the Warriors. That was it. That was as of yesterday, however. Today, it was announced he and his representatives are going to meet with three other franchises, including two in the East, which is something that I have said for a long time would behoove him a great deal. And those two teams in the East are the Boston Celtics, the Miami Heat, and then the other team in the West is the Los Angeles Clippers, which, by the way, I find to be very, very interesting, that last one. So there are six teams that he's going to have face-to-face meetings with, according to ESPN's Chris Broussard. He is also considering meeting, not locked in yet, but considering having a meeting with those New York Knicks. Would he want to go to Broadway and play at Madison Square Garden with Melo and Porzingis and now Derrick Rose? Would it be something he'd consider? I can't believe he would. I think that's got to be, if he does it, it's a last-minute throw-in meeting just to kind of say I'm looking and covering it all my bases to see what they have to say. But this is a guy who at the age of 27 is 9 years into his career and has yet to win a title. He's one of the greatest players of his generation, and he does not want to leave the league the way Charles Barkley left it, one of the greatest players of all time, let alone his generation, but known as one of those guys like Karl Malone and John Stockton and Patrick Ewing, known as one of those guys, great all-time players who couldn't get titles. He doesn't want that. And it's not that going to Golden State or going to San Antonio guarantees that he will become one of those champions, but it's what kind of a role will he play on a team that's already won a title like Golden State, not this year but last year, and a team that is already a perennial title contender. Like San Antonio. So you look at the West, and if he stays with Oklahoma City, he's got the same problem he had this year. He's got to deal with the Spurs and the Warriors and the Blazers and the Clippers and the best teams in the NBA, quite frankly, not named the Cleveland Cavaliers. Because only the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference are good enough to be mentioned with the teams that I just mentioned in the Western Conference. There's just nobody else. Not Toronto. Not Atlanta, not Detroit, not any of these other, not Miami. That's it.
That's the thing about him possibly going to the East. You know, you would think that the Kevin Durant on, say, a Boston or a Miami or somebody, most would still view the Cavs as the best, but they would view that team as a legit competition.
Oh, my
gosh. Cavs.
Yeah, well, and the most important thing is that not only would they be a contender, but the Cavs would be the only team they have to get through.
Yeah, in an East Finals scenario kind of thing, yep.
Yeah, the way LeBron, I mean, LeBron is not dumb. LeBron is all kind of smart when it comes to decision-making, not just on the court, but in terms of his career. When he left Cleveland the first time, of course it was to go to another Eastern team, knowing that it was going to be relatively easy to get to the finals each and every year with the Miami Heat because the East was then, and we're going on 6 or 7 years now, Jim, where it's pretty easy to say that the East was the least. that the Western
six or
Conference.
Seven. I still think it's more like 12 to 15 at this point. I still have the demarcation line as when Jordan retired the second time. There's been the conferences have truly been out of whack ever since then.
Okay, I'll take that. I'll give that. I wasn't going to go that far. I was just trying to be more, you know, like when he left in 2010. But okay, you can make that argument too. So he wasn't going to go anywhere but an Eastern Conference team, and when he decided to leave Miami to come back home again, he wasn't going to leave Miami and go to the West. If he had not won a title this year and wanted to leave to pursue more titles, he wasn't going to go to the West. Why? Because, again, going to the West, you've got to deal with the Spurs in one series, the Clippers in another, and probably the Warriors in the last one. And it's very easy to get knocked out before you get to another finals. You go to the East, you've got nobody to deal with because you are the big beast there, especially if you're the Cavs. Kevin Durant has to see that. He has to see that if he goes to the Spurs, that's great. Now it's LaMarcus Aldridge, and it's Kawhi Leonard, and it's Kevin Durant, and it's what's left of Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili, et cetera. And it's Patty Mills and Danny Green in the group. But they've got to still deal with Steph and Clay and Draymond and the Warriors, a 73-win team. And they still got to deal with, when healthy, CP3 and DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin and a very, very talented Clippers team. And on down the line we go. Likewise, if he goes to the Warriors, he's got to deal with all those other teams that I just mentioned before you can even get to the finals. You go to Miami and replace LeBron, essentially, in that big three. Now it's a big three instead of LeBron, Wade, and Bosch, assuming Bosch is healthy and returning from the blood clots in his lungs, etc. Now you go down there and it's Durant, Wade, and Bosch, along with Whiteside and the other complementary pieces, assuming they re-sign Whiteside.
Which will be very tricky if they're about to bring Durant on.
Exactly. But then again, everybody's going to have much more money to spend now and much more room because of the expanded cap. They'll probably find a way to get that done. But the point is, you go there, or if you go to Boston, you know, you now you're saying, well, I've only got one good team to beat to get to the finals, and it's the Cavaliers, rather than three championship caliber teams to get just to the finals and then face the Cavs. Then you face them one round earlier in the conference finals, but it's the only real beast of a team in the way. So if I'm Kevin Durant, I'm looking at the Celtics and I'm looking at the Heat very, very closely, and I'm also looking at those Knicks, and guess what else? I am also looking at the Atlanta Hawks. And I know the Hawks have changed a little bit, obviously, in the deal in which they moved Jeff Teague, but they're still a very talented team. And if they can re-sign Horford, they'll probably won't be able to re-sign swingman Bazemore, because if they were to get him. But that story just came today, by the way. I don't know if you heard this. The Atlanta Hawks have said they are indeed trying to wedge their way into the Kevin Durant sweepstakes. Sources told ESPN.com that the Hawks, like the Knicks and Lakers, have been working to try to persuade Durant to have a meeting with them face-to-face once free agency starts on Friday. Their chances appear to be slim, but they feel that the presence of Grant Hill, by the way, longtime former Piston as well, but Grant Hill being part of the ownership group with Atlanta could help them as he is close with Kevin Durant. So I would look to the East very, very. If I'm going to stay in the West, I think he's got the right approach. You join one of the two beasts that are already there.
You stay in Oklahoma City.
Well, but you really don't. Not unless you have a guarantee in writing, which they can't do, but a guarantee from Russell Westbrook that when his turn is up next year as a free agent, that he doesn't bail. Because if he bails and Durant is left now there as the only superstar in Oklahoma City, guess what you have? You have what Kevin Love had to endure in Minnesota. One of the greatest players in the game, Kevin Durant, surrounded by a bunch of parts that he cannot possibly compete with the Spurs, Warriors, Clippers, etc. in the Western Conference. He signs long-term there and Westbrook bolts. Then it's over. His chances of winning a title become slimmer and slimmer. But if you go to either the Warriors or to the Spurs, and maybe even to the Clippers, I don't know exactly how they'd work that, but if you could slide him in there with CP3 at the one, and who do they have at the two? Is it Redick? Then you've got
Redick now, yeah.
Yeah, and then you put Durant at the three. You'll obviously have Blake Griffin at the four and DeAndre Jordan at the five. That is one very, very seriously dangerous group for the Warriors and the other clubs. But you've got to stay at one of the top teams if you're going to stay in the West, because you're going to have to win three essential final series just to get to the finals like you always have. So that's where the drama is in the NBA right now. All right, that's all the time I got. I hear the music playing. I did want to get to some baseball, but we'll hold off to tomorrow. I want to talk about the Mets signing of Jose Reyes, the controversy surrounding that. I certainly want to talk about the Tigers trying to bounce back from their sweep at the hands of the Indians. They got the Marlins. I want to talk about the Indians, see if they can win 11 in a row tonight against the Braves. We'll get into all of that tomorrow on the Extravaganza and much, much more. Until then, enjoy Mike Miller and Drive Time. That's coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.